Coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK,
The Lutheran Inquisitor, examining pressing issues and their ramifications for the Church today.
Hello and welcome to The Lutheran Inquisitor. I'm your host, John Ehlers. I'm pastor of Christ Lutheran Church in Orpington, Kent, a southeastern suburb of London. I'd like to invite you along to attend one of our services. We meet at 10:30 every Sunday morning, and we also have a 7 o'clock evening service each Wednesday. Or check us out on Facebook at facebook.com/Christ Lutheran Church UK. I also serve as vacancy pastor for St. Columba Lutheran Church in East Kilbride, Scotland. Again, they meet each Sunday morning at 11 a.m., and I know they'd love to see you if you live in the Glasgow area. If you don't live in any of these locations, why not go to our website, lutheran.co.uk, click on the directory button, find the congregation nearest you, and go and pay them a visit. I know you'll receive a warm welcome. I'd also like to thank you for your prayerful and your financial support of Lutheran Radio. Without your prayers, without your contributions, we wouldn't be able to carry on this ministry, so we are deeply grateful to you for your care. Today we welcome Dr. Asger Christian Hoylen. He is a professor on the free faculty of the University of Aarhus in Denmark. He recently gave a paper at the European Lutheran Conference on finding hope in the writings of Martin Luther in 1520. And we're very pleased to have him as a guest. Dr. Hoylen, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, as I mentioned in our introduction, you recently gave a paper at the European Lutheran Conference, and the title of your paper was Martin Luther's Writings in 1520 and how they brought hope, or how you found hope in them. And you started off with basically a review of some of the events leading up to and precipitating these writings. Could you give us an overview of what happened and what brought these writings about?
1520 was in the middle or in the end of a period of time which was really a very tense period of time for Martin Luther. As we all know, it started with the 95 Theses from October 1517. And from then on, things happened in a very fast speed. He was, before that, a quite unknown friar or professor in Wittenberg. Known in Wittenberg, but not outside. But only 2 or 1 year later, he was known all over Germany. The end of this period of very turmoil, you could say, was in Worms in 1521, turned up before the emperor and all the nobility, all the leaders of the German nation, and it was commanded to withdraw all what he said. So in a period of 3.5 years, things really happened. He hadn't anticipated this to happen when he came with this 95 theses at all. This was an academic discussion, which is he initiated, and he didn't want any more of that. But the church in Rome saw a great danger in it, to its finances, primarily maybe. So they started a case against it almost instantly, tried to silence him, trying first to have his religious order to silence him, in Heidelberg in April 1518, which did not happen. Then others tried to silence him, writing against him. He was asked to come to Rome to have his case tried there, which his prince, Frederick the Wise, didn't want, because Luther was a very popular professor in Wittenberg, and Wittenberg was a new university, which it was quite a prestige project for this Prince Frederick the Wise. So he didn't want him to go to Rome. He knew what would happen which if he came there. So instead, a cardinal came from Rome, and this was in Augsburg, and now we are in the autumn of 1518, trying to get Luther withdraw there, which he didn't succeed. Luther wanted to discuss things. He wanted to hear and to learn from this renowned cardinal, but he didn't get the answers. He just got an order to withdraw, and so Luther didn't want to do that either. And things went on, and people wrote against him. He had a very renowned discussion or dispute with Johann Eck in Leipzig in 1519. Now it's really been a matter not only of universities, but the prince there also joined this discussion and was impressed by it in many ways. Many opponents wrote against Luther, trying to learn, teach him that the Pope really was the only one who had the authority to define doctrine in the Church. And Luther answered, all these years were filled with writings, and at the same time, Luther had the time to be what he was normally. He was a professor, having his lectures. He was a pastor, preaching in the churches almost every day, and having the contact with the congregation too there, and having the contact with the publishers, because now Luther also started publishing treatises, books, academic writings, popular writings. He actually became one of the absolutely most read authors of his days, by far much more than everybody else in Germany then. So it was a period of an enormous workload and enormous attention, consciousness of his life being threatened, because he knew that if the Pope got his way, he would end his life on the bonfire, just like Johann Hus had done 100 years before. So this is a little about what happened in those years.
You've got us to the year 1520 now. And in 1520, you note how Luther wrote many seminal works. Can you tell us, I suppose, just briefly about some of those before we get into them in a little more depth?
1520 was the year where he wrote what was later called the main reformational books. Three of them are called that, but there is one added to that, which is as seminal and as the others. And that is the first one, the Treatise of the Good Works, which was released in June 1520. It's a book about faith, you can say. Faith as the core, not only of our relationship to God, but of our daily life. Faith as the main thing when it comes to living the life which God wants us to live, and with the Ten Commandments as the frame of it, to the faith being the fulfilling of the first commandment, having God as our God, and that being the core of every other thing we do in our lives. So faith and our daily life, that's what it's about in Treatise of Good Works. And just after finishing that, he was working on the next one, which really is one of the main reformational writings. This time, a writing directed to, you can say, the worldly leaders of the nation. It's called To the Christian Nobility of the German Nation, concerning the reformation of the Christian estate, which was not released until August 20, but it was written during the summer 20. A very outspoken book to the nobility to do what the church didn't want to do, to summon a council in order to have a reformation of the church, which it dearly needed, showing how the church really had not the authority to deny everybody else to have any authority there. And then, after this, the next also very outspoken polemical writing, this time concerning the spiritual power of the church, was released. That was in October in 1520. was called On the Babylonian Captivity of the Church. And though the Babylonian captivity was the captivity of the Roman bishop and the papal court, because they held the church in a captivity through their notion of what the sacraments were about and their way of using the sacraments, using them as chains for the church, as chains for the church, where the sacraments were gifts from God, gifts to strengthen faith, to strengthen life, normal Christian life. That was what the sacraments were about. The church has turned them into weapons for themselves to keep the church under in a captivity. And then after these two very outspoken polemical writings, the last one of the main reformational writings was The Freedom of the Christian, the treatise on the freedom of the church and Christian, which was released in November. So all through 1520, he was writing all these absolutely seminal writings. At the same time, as he was a pastor, he was a professor, and as a professor also was preparing lessons on the Psalms, which he also published through this time. So it was in quite an old workload he had in those days.
And I suspect for most of us, boy, that would have been way too much. We'd have crumbled. But how did Luther manage to keep his hope even in the midst of all of these controversies and in the midst of all of this workload?
One of the answers many would point at is his personality, no doubt. He was a gifted person, no doubt. He had many gifts to draw on, really. And his courage and his cheerfulness and his stubbornness, no doubt, were gifts to him in that situation. That does not mean that he was an invulnerable person. He could be fragile too. We know that from his spiritual fightings, his Anfechtungen, what we do call it. We know that he, from time to time, had very, very severe fights with the devil, with his conscience, with God, fearing that God had rejected him, fearing of the anger of the wrath of God, which were very deep. At the same time, he also was this very gifted man who had known, had seen something which he knew that he had to bring forth to people of his times. He was very different from his good friend Philip Melanchthon in this respect. His good friend Philip Melanchthon was quite a genius. He was a fragile person, and in spite of that, he was in charge of negotiations when Luther had not the possibility to be there because he was outlawed. And he was very, very hard pressed in these situations. But so these two friends were very different in that way. Melanchthon, a very clear-minded man and fragile in these situations. And Luther, not at all as fragile when it comes to the opposition from the opponents, not at all. But that is not the only answer, I think. That's only a part of the answer. But God uses us with the gifts we have, but we cannot rely on those alone. Something else must be there. And that was, I think, the main answer when it comes to where Luther gained his hope from in this period.
So if it's not just Luther's personality, not just the force of his character, what did you discover then by reading these writings of 1520? How did they help you to see where Luther found that hope?
I think it comes very much from what Luther himself had seen through his evangelical discovery, as we call it, his discovery, what you can say, of God himself. That is what the evangelical discovery is about. It's about discovering who God is and discovering that God is not the aloof and far away God that also people at that time thought about God, but that God is the God who we see in Jesus Christ. That was his discovery of God, discovering that God deals with us through sending his son, deals with us through sending through his son all another view of him, another notion of him, another relation to him. That is, I think, the core of the answer and to how he gained hope. He had seen God, you can say. He had met God and seen God through Christ. And that is what he tries to get through to people, through the gospel, through the preaching, and through his teaching, to turn people's faces to this God and show who he is through what he has shown himself to be through the Bible.
And I love how you make it so practical when you pointed to some of the other things, the lesser known things he wrote in the 19s and the 20s. You talk about his sermons and his consolation for those who are dying. Can you tell us a little bit about those?
People turn to Luther to get different kinds of advice and consolation. He was not only the aloof professor, but he was really also the preacher and the advisor. And he wrote quite some writings just on these topics. One of them was a writing preparing people to die, which was very near to people at that time, more to than we maybe experience it today. How can you die in a manner which gives you peace at heart, which you can, maintains peace at heart? That he wrote a writing there, and it was very practical. It was a writing about how to make a will, how to talk to the people which you knew and get things talked about which had been between you, and then slowly turning the faces of the people to what death is and what it achieves to us and who Christ is, who has turned the death not to a defeat but to a victory for us. That is one of his writings, a very wonderful writing about this topic. And another writing I read in this connection was a writing which he actually wrote to the chaplain of Fred the Wise, when Fred the Wise was very ill, trying to relieve him, trying to console him, trying to turn his face away from all the disasters which he now thought that he faced being very ill, trying to fix his eyes away from what would take hope away from him, to the God who is the one who keeps you alive all the way, also often death. Very practical, very direct, not so, you can say, biblical all through as you would expect from Luther at that time, but biblical and practical.
Dr. Hoyland, do we have any record of how that was received by Prince Frederick?
Well, I didn't read any record of that. There were not very many contacts between, direct contacts between Fred the Wise and Luther. We think all of Fred the Wise being a very close to Luther. He was not. Luther never met Frederick the Wise, actually. He always had the relationship to him through this chaplain, Spalatin. So I have never come across how Frederick the Wise actually received this, but we know that many in the time saw this writing as a very, very good writing. Even some of his enemies saw it as a very good writing, as a consolation also for people outside. The very renowned Erasmus of Rotterdam was one of them, the one who he wrote against in 1525 about the free will. He rejoiced also for this writing, actually.
And you mention in this writing that Luther uses sort of seven contrasting pictures. Can you tell us a little bit about those? Because I found that to be very fascinating as well.
He writes, you can say, a way that resembles an altarpiece. You look on an altar, there are seven pieces, there are cuttings or paintings on the altar depicting different kinds of persons or situations. And Luther does that in words, you can say. He tries to turn his eyes and make him meditate on some, you can say, written altarpieces, different kinds of evils, different kinds of goods which we meet in our lives, evils which we can use also in our way of seeing how God also, when things go wrong, is there, and that the evils where we actually experience are nothing against what we could have experienced if things really had gone wrong. And the same thing with the goods, how God helps us through goods which we actually experience in our lives and which we don't see through and see as the goods of God himself. So he depicts, you can say, in a mental way, a meditation altarpiece for the meditation of the prince.
And I like how you then sort of say we could spend a lot of time on those three or even four seminal writings you talk about, but you kind of take us a little bit in a different direction, where you go to the lectures that Luther was preparing on the Psalms to really hone in on his understanding of hope in the Christian life. Can you tell us maybe why you decided to go that way and how that worked out and what you learned from that?
The main preoccupation Luther had in those days as a professor was this lecture on the Psalms. So it's a very important writing, actually, even if it's not so well known. And in this lecture on the Psalms, there is what you can call an excursus on our topic, the topic of hope. Concerning hope and suffering, Luther calls this excursus, where he tries to say something more than the running exposition is able to do about what hope is all about. As he says, it's about how we can maintain hope also during suffering in life, the hope which the Psalms are so very much marked by. That is what Luther talks about when he talks about hope these days. It's what the force and the nature of hope in our lives. It's how trembling, weak, and simple consciences can get a firm foundation for their lives. In this excursus, he begins by turning against the current teaching of hope in the church. It was a teaching which was focusing very much on our own effort. Luther quotes the medieval dogmatic textbook, which was Petrus Lombardus's Sentences, where Petrus Lombardus says, "Hope is a certain expectation of a reward springing out of merits," with the word merits as a very important word there. "Hope is a certain expectation of a reward springing out of merits." So the idea is that it is through constantly working on doing God's will and gaining merits through that, following Christ, etc., that the steadfast reassurance of hope grows forth. Petrus Lombardus uses a citation of Cicero here. He says, and he quotes Cicero, "It's the consciousness of a well-spent life is a most sweet reflection." This is what Peter Lombardus says hope is. It is the consciousness of a well-spent life. And Luther reacts awfully against this, vehemently against this. He, as he said, "This is not to do theology, but diabology. To use your own life as the threadstone, as the basis of your hope. And how impossible it is to build one's hope on this, and how futile this hope is, becomes very clear as soon as you really are faced by adversities and obstacles of some kind. It could be a misfortune, the prevailing on your enemies, the slander of colleagues. It could be poverty, or it could be sickness, or the obstacle above all, death. When you are faced by death, how will this hope be able to withstand? How will this hope be able to carry you through this? Often, you see, people who have based their hopes on their own merits, when they are faced by these things, the hope crumbles. Things fall apart. Luther illustrates it by imagining what happens at the deathbed of a man who has based his life on this kind of hope, where he, full of self-reproach, will lie there crying, "Oh, miserable man that I am. Oh, if I had but now done many good things. Oh, if I had but now not done any evil. If I had but remained pure." That is where this kind of hope ends. So that was how he begins this excursus. And the problem with this kind of hope is that you build it on your own merit, that you build it on what you self are able to do, then it crumbles. But then he shows that it can't be, that only those who have been successful in this can have hope, because the Bible says everybody can have this hope. That is what the verse in Psalm 15:12 says. Let all that hope in you rejoice. So how can a hope, which is a hope for all, be there if it's built upon your own efforts? There must be something quite else that you can build your hope on. And then he talks about the only way to have this hope is to have God as the wellspring of the hope, not your own efforts. The key to a steadfast hope can only be God himself. Not ourselves, not things that we ourselves establish or are involved in. They will all crumble. But God himself, that is how you get to the real hope that stands. God, who is the only one that stands fast in this life. Everything else will crumble and do crumble. And by focusing on what we are to do, you focus on what crumbles. Inevitably will crumble. You must have your hope based on something quite else, on that which doesn't crumble, which is only God.
Thank you, Dr. Hoyland, for bringing us to that really good place to conclude today, that our hope, as the old hymn says, is built on nothing less than Jesus' blood and righteousness. Would you be willing to join us next week and carry on this conversation?
All right, I'll do that.
Great. So we hope our listeners will join us as well. Go in peace and serve the Lord.
Thank you for listening to the Lutheran Inquisitor with Pastor John Ehlers. If you have any questions or comments about the issues raised in this program, send an email to info@lutheranradio.co.uk. The podcast of this show is available from our website. Check our program online and stay tuned.